Can you walk us through, like, you wake up on a Monday, what do you eat?
Steak. I'm serious.
So no butter.
Well,
no,
I mean, you can watch his YouTube and you'll see.
Without exaggeration, I've been doing this nearly 8 years. I've probably consumed, and again, without exaggeration, close to 10,000 steaks in 8 years. I mean, I eat two or three steaks every single day. I average about 3 pounds of red meat every single day I've been doing so. I'm currently in a kind of a leaning out phase, so I mean slightly less than that. Over the years, my diet has been, you know, with rare exception, I eat 2 meals a day, you know, at maintenance, I guess. I'm trying to maintain my body weight. I'll maybe eat 2 pounds of steak for breakfast. And then I usually try to eat dinner relatively early if I do, and it's about 2 pounds for dinner, or maybe slightly less. Sometimes I'll have some eggs. Sometimes I'll throw some seafood in there. I'll have some dairy occasionally, a piece of cheese occasionally, something like that. Rarely, I mean, we're talking a couple times a year. I might have a piece of cake. I was like, fuck it, I'm gonna have a piece of cake. But it's such a minuscule part of my diet that it's effectively, I eat meat pretty much exclusively.
Futures Edge. I am Jim Uriel. That's Bob Iacino. Today is a special show. As you guys who watch the show know that 60-70% of it is hardline finance, macroeconomics, and trading. But then the other 30-40%, we do pop culture, we do health, and we do policy, not politics. Never politics, always policy. Our special guest today, and Bobby and I did not do this on purpose, but we both wore our tight black t-shirts because he's extremely fit. And we want to show him that we're not, maybe not in his league, but we're not miles off. Okay.
Good for you.
But it is Dr. Sean Baker of the Carnivore Diet fame. And you have another company too that's helping people with their fitness journey. What's it called?
Our company is called Rivero.com. It is basically all 50 state licensed physicians that are there to, just basically what I think the way medicine should be practiced. We should be getting people off meds. We should be treating root cause of disease and not just chronically medicating people. So that is that's what we do there. So Rivero.com.
So here, this is my history, and I don't want this to make it about me at all, but for just a minute, is that I've trained kids through their fitness journey for about the last 30 years, probably 500-600 kids. It sickens me when I see the obesity that, and I think that whatever metrics they're using to measure right now are ridiculously inadequate. I think in the last 4 years, and maybe there's a small percentage of the population that's gotten fit and taken things seriously and changed their life, but there is a much, much bigger portion of the population that has gained a shit ton of weight. I see it everywhere I go, riding the L. It's amazing. This is by far the worst health epidemic I've ever seen. How did you get into this and get into your line?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm a physician. So, I mean, I went through the conventional route of becoming an allopathic physician. I was an orthopedic surgeon. So I used to replace knees and shoulders and fix fractures and do sports, you know, sports injuries and so on and so forth. And my whole life, I've always been an athlete. So that's always been sort of who I am, basically. But it's been about 10, 12, 15 years ago now, I started to, you know, have this sort of realization that I'm getting older and not doing as well as I want to. You know, I'm still trying, but I found that by kind of radically altering my nutrition that I, you know, experienced tremendous health benefits. And there was a period of time where I was replacing, you know, as a community, we were replacing people's knees, and we had a lot of obese patients, and obese patients just have higher complication rates. There's just no getting around it. They're harder to operate on. They get infected more often. They have blood clots more often. They just have worse outcomes across the board. So as a community, we came together and just said, look, we're just not going to operate on these obese patients. We're going to force them to lose weight, which is no small task. I mean, it's challenging to get people to lose weight, as many people know. And during that process, I started, you know, recommending diets that were, you know, kind of low in sugar and grains and lower carbohydrates. And lo and behold, you know, not everybody would do that. I mean, most people, probably 80% of people said, no, I'm not going to change my diet. But of those people that did do that, a significant portion of them would come to my office 2 weeks afterwards and say, hey, you know what, doc, I know we're scheduled to have surgery in 6 weeks, but my knee doesn't hurt anymore. And that was a really sort of revelatory moment for me that I was like, wait a minute, You know, you've got x-rays that show your knee looks like crap. It looks like a dog had chewed on it and stuck it back in there. And you're telling me your knee doesn't hurt anymore. Well, if your knee doesn't hurt anymore, we don't really have a good reason to do surgery on you. And that's really what kind of was the genesis of me sort of delving into this in a more, you know, kind of in a very significant way. And so now, as I mentioned, I am wholly in on board on lifestyle, nutrition, sleep, exercise, all those things which are so incredibly important. The things that we often ignore as physicians. I mean, we clearly do. I mean, we kind of give lip service to that, but there's no real teeth into that message. It's more just, you know, Medicaid and, you know, and manage symptoms and do that ad infinitum, which is to the detriment of really everybody involved, except for the people that make a lot of money off of that. For those, that's a great model.
Dr. Baker, I want to start by thanking you because I have, first of all, I don't even like calling it the carnivore diet. I really don't. It's kind of annoying because the whole diet thing makes it seem like it's a fad, it's temporary, it's something that you're almost like it's a challenge of sorts, which I don't like. Lately, I've been talking to some people about it, mostly people that I care about, but I never really wanted to evangelize for it. But I do want to thank you because I've been doing it probably for about, it's a little under 6 months now. And it's been physically life-changing. And just if I could, normally my diatribes before the question are much longer than the question. And I'm going to do that here as well, just for a minute. I promise to get to questions.
Normally Bobby has later. A two-nap question. You're very well-rested after two nap questions.
So I moved to Florida about 3.5 years ago now. And I watched your video where you said you were really happy to have access to the beach and all that. And I would highly recommend it. Okay. Even wait for the house price to go down, whatever you want to do. But I stepped out of my car one day, got a diagnosis of a partially torn meniscus. I didn't twist it. I didn't do anything. I just stepped out of the car. The next thing you know, I'm limping. I can't put weight on it. It's that point where I realized I was about 214 pounds at the time. I'm only 5'9". Inch and a half taller than Jim.
Bullshit.
As of this morning, I was 179. Now, through that process, I did a lot of different things. I did 75 hard. I did whole 30, all these things. But the one thing that never changed was my desire to get to the end of whatever I was doing so that I could go back to some of these foods and behaviors that I was still craving. Okay. Going 100% animal-based, other than the coffee that I just drank here, my espresso, has taken those cravings away completely. Mm. Now, what is that physiologically, chemically? What is that? What's happening there? Because now the one thing is, I remember doing Whole 30 where I was like, I can't wait to have a big bowl of pasta with some shaved Parmesan on it and just, you know, maybe even some ravioli and some meatballs and whatever else. I don't crave it anymore. And that's where I've gotten some pushback from some of my family members for trying this. Is because they have said things like, I want my cravings.
Yeah. Well, I mean, first of all, I mean, just some of the things you referenced, you know, doing the 75 hard and all these other things that we do, getting good sleep, supplementation, none of that makes a hill of beans difference if you don't stop poisoning yourself. And so, I mean, you got to stop poisoning yourself. And I'm not saying that vegetables are trying to kill you, but a significant portion of our U.S. food supply literally is that. I mean, all the crap that is friggin' illegal in half the world, we just, you know, consume by the, you know, the bushel. I mean, there's, we you know, these ingredients. So you gotta cut all that ultra processed garbage out, first of all. And, you know, the thing is that, you know, if you were to take somebody who's an alcoholic and said, hey man, just on the weekends, just have a couple of martinis, you're good. That ain't working. I mean, it just does not work. So there is some component of hyperpalatable, hyperaddictive food that is known on, I mean, we have food scientists whose job it is to literally create addictive food. I mean, that is their job. I mean, I've talked to them and they feel really bad about it in retrospect. They're like, I spent my whole career addicting people to garbage and I feel awful about it. So that certainly exists. You know, there's these new drugs on the market. They've been around for a while, but the purpose for weight loss, these sort of GLP-1 receptor agonists, Ozempic, Mounjaro, Wegovy, and some of the other ones, Tirzepatide, they act on something called an incretin hormone, which there's a couple of them in our body, GIP, gastric inhibitory peptide, GLP-1, glucagon-like peptide 1. And beef actually has a profound similar effect in a very physiologically appropriate way. So you sense that satiety that you don't normally get when you're eating chips and salsa or whatever it might be, you just can't stop eating the stuff because there's no real satiety associated with that. So that's one aspect of it. The other aspect of it is, you know, those foods that we have a hard time giving up or we are sort of addicted to, they reinforce that behavior. They actually rewire our brain in a way. We see new neural synapses that are formed that encourage that behavior. And the food scientists know this. I mean, they designed this intentionally. They're like, oh, look, it lights up this brain circuit and it rechanges our brain so we can't stop eating this stuff. I mean, this stuff has been known for 40 or 50 years, and we still sort of continue to perpetuate that by just the behaviors that we have. And so it is, it's like, you know, sometimes you need to have total abstinence to free yourself of the effects of these things because they are wildly addictive. And I know there's people say, well, there's no such thing as what drives me crazy. You have all this whole dietitian industry saying there's no such thing as bad food, everything in moderation. And yet you've got literally fluorescent blue Captain Crunch flavored artificial maple syrup. And you're telling me that's food? No, it's not. No one should be eating that garbage. And there's a lot of foods like that. And yet we have this whole industry that is well-funded and propagandized to tell you that you can eat anything and it's all good food. When this stuff didn't even exist on this planet, you know, 20 years ago. And now we're eating 70% of our diet is ultra processed food. So it does have a profound effect on satiety. And you're not the first person to say it. And oh, by the way, people that go carnivore will often find that, hey, they don't feel like drinking anymore. They don't feel like drinking alcohol. We've got alcoholics who are like, you know, I don't really need that shit.
It's
people
crazy.
Can give up cigarette smoking more easily. I mean, it's just all tied into the brain physiology in a very significant way. And that's something I've been observing for years and years now. It's just really kind of an interesting thing. And so, you know, it's people say, I can't do it. It's too restrictive, but it's also very extremely freeing. It's like, I'm no longer held captive by the sway of this hyper palatable stuff. I mean, I literally can be in a room and I'm a guy to love desserts, man. I used to say, hey man, eat dessert first. Cause you know, never know when you're going to die. I mean, that was my attitude up until a certain
sooner if you eat dessert first.
Right. So now I can be, I mean, and I still find those things tasty. They still taste good to me, but I really literally don't want them. I'm like, yeah, I don't need it. I'm good. I'm happy with my damn steak. And I'm not depriving myself. I mean, hell, I eat ribeye steak most days. It's like that. That's like, when do you ever cheat? I like every day is a cheat meal for me. I'm eating good stuff every day as far as I'm concerned.
That's, you know, that's the amazing part of it, Dr. Baker, to me is that, so we went out the other night and I want to go to Jimmy, but we went out the other night and there really wasn't anything pure carnivore on the menu. So I got a piece of chicken parmesan, which, you know, was breaded and probably fried in olive oil. And but I was able to eat it. The part that was getting me was the tomato sauce. But now I know I have problems with nightshade fruit or vegetables. I mean, the tomatoes have bothered me when I've re-entered them in after being sort of on this diet. It takes away the stress of knowing what to eat. You know, my wife and I never go, so what should we have tonight? We never say that anymore. Because we always know exactly what we're going to say. And to your point about sweets, the two people I was with, my wife and another friend, ordered dessert. I had one bite. I didn't need any. I didn't want any more. I've never left dessert on the table unfinished. Go ahead, Jimmy.
Now, so you briefly, tangentially mentioned alcohol. Now, the answer to this question is going to be very, very important for me. So I eat not a carnivore diet, but it's a high protein, high fat, low inflammation diet, very, very little sugar. I'm proud of my diet, but I am a one... you know, martini a night guy, Tito's vodka. Am I just blowing it all by having a drink at night?
Well, I mean, alcohol is not a health food. I mean, I get it. I mean, I have in the course of a year, probably the equivalent of two bottles of red wine in an entire year. I mean, that's the extent of my, I just don't have a great desire to do it. I'm always, you know, doing things athletically and pushing myself. And that to me doesn't contribute positively in any significant way. Honestly, you have to say, hey, look, am I better with or without it and test it yourself. And if it's not a significant difference, then hey, life happens and life is, you know, you've got to make compromises to some degree. I mean, there's air pollution. I mean, I can't go live into the hills of them, you know, live in the mountains of Himalaya to avoid air pollution. I mean, there's these things that are there that are going to be there. Now, is it one martini a night or is it three on the weekend? You know, there's a point where there's an accumulative effect. And for me, I mean, yeah, I mean, there's some things that just quite honestly, they're not good for us. But I mean, again, it's there's the dose makes a poison. How often are you doing it? What does it lead to? If the martini then leads to, hey, let's have two. And then all of a sudden, hey, let's order dessert. And, it sometimes causes other downstream negative effects. And so if you're very disciplined, then and some people can handle that. But I mean, I know there's a lot of it, a lot of evidence to say alcohol in moderation, you know, a glass of red wine a couple times a week is actually associated with better health outcomes. I think in recent times, more people have come to the conclusion that alcohol is just, it's just not good for us, regardless of the amount or the type. So I like everyone else, I'm a human being. I'm pretty damn strict on my diet, but I have a piece of cake every once in a while. I've said that many times. I'm not like a reverse vegan where I've got this ideologic, oh my God, I'm saving the tomatoes type of thing. I don't care. I could care less. All I care about is, how I feel and how I perform. So, I mean, the short answer is probably a minimal amount is for most people. Okay. You gotta test it yourself to see if that's truly beneficial.
The funny thing you mentioned that alcohol oftentimes leads to bad decisions, which my whole dating life was based upon that premise, and it worked out okay. This is just out of curiosity, because the answer to this question might not necessarily further this conversation, but I look at the FDA, USDA health pyramid or food pyramid, whatever the hell that bullshit was that they unveiled back in the 70s. It almost seems like we can all agree that it was just a massive mistake, ridiculous. 80% of your calories shouldn't be coming from simple carbs, whatever it was. It almost seems like it was malice, and it was intended and pushed by different lobbies, cereal lobby, shit like that. Do you get mad about when you look at that? Do you think that they did this on purpose, or they're just incompetent?
No, I mean, I think that, I think the USDA, first of all, should not be dictating our dietary policy, because USDA's mission is to sell commodities. I mean, we've got corn, wheat, grain, sugar, soybeans, beef, eggs, dairy, whatever. I mean, their mission is to sell all that shit, and it doesn't matter how healthy it is. I mean, honestly, that's where it is. And if you look at the members of the US Dietary Guidelines Committee, 95% of them have financial interest in food companies. So it's honestly ridiculous. And I think we'd be better off, honestly, with just out any policy. Just say, hey, eat whatever works best for you. I mean, Brazil, for all the problems they have currently, had at least at one time a very, what I thought was a reasonable food guideline. It was basically minimize or limit processed food, cook your food at home, and eat food with people you love. And I think that probably is a hell of a lot better advice than limit your saturated fat to 10% and cut your added, it's just crap. I mean, it's really, again, this everything in moderation policy. You sell all our commodities in moderation. In fact, it's interesting because I've been trying to get the beef industry to help fund some studies on this carnivore diet, because I think it is so incredibly necessary and needed, because I mean, there's a lot of people doing it anyway. We might as well research it and see what the hell is going on here. And even the beef industry itself, they get money, they obtain money through what's called the beef checkoff, which the USDA kind of oversees. And they're not allowed to say like beef is good and sugar is bad. That's verboten. They cannot disparage any other commodity. And this is the way this system works. Sell all the commodities. We want to keep everybody in business. And I get that. You want to run the economy. You want to have a thriving supermarket and restaurant scene and processed food scene. But the downside of that is we got a lot of sick people, and it is seriously negatively impacting our health as a society, our economy. I mean, you got a bunch of sick people, hell, 25% of the people are walking around with some kind of mental illness and on meds for that. How can we have a functional society when everybody's freaking crazy or nuts or scared or violent or anxious? I mean, that doesn't add up. So anyway, that's some of the bigger picture stuff that we got going on.
I mean, you can even see it in the hospitals. I had a relative I'm very close with have a stroke recently, and I mean, they're talking about opening up both carotid arteries, right? Yeah. Both sides. Both were blocked. One was like 95, the other was like 79. Had a massive stroke, luckily no after effects. And we go to see him in the hospital, and he's got Jell-O and pudding and a hamburger on a soft white bun. He was able to get a vegan burger if he wanted, but they still brought the bun. I mean, I'm looking at this and I'm going, this is completely insane to me. I have a list of questions for you. And obviously a lot of them come from me having eaten this way now for about 6 months. And I got to stress to people watching this again, I had shoulder pain, lower back pain, left knee pain, gone inside of 3 weeks, gone. Okay. I had a little bit of lethargy for about the first 10 days or so. And then all of a sudden, just boom, through the roof. So I started talking to people that I cared about, family members. And other than that, I don't care. I go to a restaurant, order a steak. That's what I do, right? Nobody asks me because I'm ordering a steak. It's not like you're ordering a nut loaf with parsnip gravy, which people would ask a question about. I'm ordering a steak. Nobody even bothers. So people don't bother you. The cholesterol conversation, Dr. Baker. Obviously, that's probably what you get first and foremost. How do you address that? You talked in one of your videos about a study that had just concluded about 2 years of a longer term study where there were lean mass hyper responders. Can you talk about all that?
Yeah. So, I mean, first of all, I am not of the opinion that we should ignore cholesterol. I mean, I think there is some relevance to that. I think it is a problem for a large percentage of people. The question we have is, can you negate the risk of cholesterol by dialing in everything else, by being lean, by being in a low inflammatory state, by having good glycemic control, being quote unquote metabolically healthy? Because if we look at something called metabolic syndrome, LDL cholesterol is not part of that equation. It's basically glycemia, it's obesity, it's HDL, it's triglycerides. I mean, those are the things that form the metabolic syndrome. There is a study that came out of Denmark last year that looked at people with something called a CAC score. That's a coronary artery calcium score. And if it was zero, which means you have no evidence of heart disease, the LDL cholesterol over a period of time had no bearing, zero bearing. But if your CAC score was positive, then it did have a bearing. So it seems to be a dependent variable. That is to say, it's important, but it depends on other things. And what are those other things? And those things are still things I think we're still kind of discovering. There is a large study going on that Matt Budoff at UCLA through the Lundquist Institute is doing right now. The preliminary data was released, which was quite interesting. Basically, they took people with enormously high cholesterol. We're talking LDL cholesterol, 300, 400, 500. You know, if you walk into your doctor's office with that, they're going to be like, the doctor's going to have a heart attack, freaking out. He's going to send you to a cardiologist, to the cath lab right away. So we got this population that was older, like average age of 55. So perfect prime age to see heart disease. And they did high level scans, you know, angiography, CT angiography studies on these people. And they compared them to a similar age cohort of healthy people. And what they saw was zero difference in the amount of plaque in their heart, in their arteries. So there was no change.
Wasn't the median age
55,
around 50?
I think it was around 55. Like that. So yeah. No difference in this subset of people who had been on a very low carb, high fat, super high cholesterol diet for at least 5 years. So, you know, the critics will say, well, it's not long enough to see anything. And what we have right now, and it's not been published yet, so it's coming out probably this summer. They follow these people for 1 year, which is what they do for the drug trials. I mean, it's good enough for the drug trials. In fact, Matt Budoff is one of the world leading authorities on how fast plaque can progress on CT angiography. So he's the guy. The guy said 6 months is long as you need to show a difference, and they did it for a year, and they're going to do it for another 3 years, I think, on top of that. So that data likely will show no progression of disease in these people with this super high cholesterol. So that's not everybody in the population, but it is a subset of people. So if you get yourself metabolically fit and healthy, there is some indication that the cholesterol may not be driving the heart disease like it does for the vast majority of the population. And the doctors are usually right, because the vast majority of the people that roll into the doctor's office, they're sedentary, they're pre-diabetic, they're overweight. They just don't take care of themselves. And so the question becomes, what if you do all the things right? Is it still an issue? And the answer to that right now, I would say, is we don't know for sure, but there's seemingly more evidence that it's probably not the concern that we're led to believe. Again, I'll just say more data to come on that one.
Okay. Can I branch it off? And I want to get, you know, some solid takeaways. I know that, you know, sugar, alcohol, processed foods, we already talked about those things. We're talking about something else real quick, and the relationship to cancer and cancer being perhaps potentially a metabolic disorder. I mean, in the 1930s, Otto Warburg won a Nobel Prize for trying to prove that cancer was a metabolic syndrome. I do the ice baths because one of the reasons I do is I believe that potentially it could be sucking glucose out of the blood, bringing it to the brown fat, all that. I don't know if you where you stand on those things, but can you talk to what research has been done on cancer and its relationship to the carnivore diet, its relationship to not having all that processed junk in your body?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that when we look at cancer, is because everybody will say, well, you know, red meat is associated with colorectal cancer. And this is, you know, 2015 World Health Organization, IARC, back in Lyon, France, made a proclamation. They said, well, look, unprocessed red meat is a class two carcinogen, meaning probable carcinogen. And the basis of that was basically almost completely based on epidemiologic surveys, which are fraught with confounders and problems and not very good science. And everybody admits it's not very good science. There were a couple of rat studies that were also utilized in that, and almost no actual human interventional data was used in making that proclamation. And that proclamation was wildly contested within the committee. There was a whole bunch of dissenting voices. One of them, forget the guy's name right now, I'll think of it in a minute, but David Clearfield, was it Professor David Clearfield? He basically said this was the most frustrating experience of his entire career because they literally ignored all the data that went against their basically preconceived result. World Health Organization, right. Also, again, heavily funded by Bill Gates, who's heavily invested in fake meat. So there's some conflicts of interest in there. And something like 30% of that panel was vegan, vegetarian, or Seventh-day Adventist, which are, you know, religiously opposed to eating meat. So there was a lot of problem with that. There's been a number of studies since that time that have come out and said this isn't good science, and we've got data that shows that that's not really, there's no real strong link between that. But to your question about how do we prevent cancer, gosh, if we look at the, you know, some of the other risk factors for cancer, and they're kind of the same, cardiovascular disease runs the same way. Obesity, probably one of the bigger ones. I mean, gosh, almost most major cancers are strongly correlated with obesity. What does a carnivore diet do generally to obesity? It eliminates it. When we talk specifically with colorectal cancer, if you have inflammatory bowel disease, Crohn's disease, or ulcerative colitis, your risk for colorectal cancer, according to some studies, is increased by 3,000%. That's a 30x increase, right? What does a carnivore diet do to people with Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis? It basically clears it up for most people, for many people. In fact, we've got a study coming out, a case series that'll be done partially at Harvard and with some other researchers where I help compile that. So, you know, Otto Warburg's, you know, the metabolic theory, Thomas Seyfried is another proponent of this. He's over at Boston University, I believe. You know, they talk about the fact that, you know, our mitochondria are impacted by nutrition and things like glucose and also specifically glutamate are fuels for these cancer cells. And if you deprive those cancer cells of these types of fuel, they don't have anything to eat and they don't grow. And then our immune system, which is constantly surveilling it for cancers. I mean, our body is always having cells that potentially could become cancerous and our immune system just wipes them out. So by enhancing our immune system, by not feeding the cells, you know, we kind of tip the scale in the favor. At least that's the theory, the metabolic theory on this. And there's, as far as research, I mean, there are some case reports and brain tumors, things like glioblastoma multiforme, which are really aggressive brain tumors, astrocytomas and things like that, where they have kept the cancer in complete remission for, you know, more than 10 years, which is wildly longer than the normal life expectancy. So there is some data, early data coming out on that. There's a lot of study on ketogenic diets, for instance, looking at cancer. So that data is getting stronger and stronger. The problem really with a lot of this is just the funding. I mean, it's really tough to pay for these studies. They're very expensive to do them to the numbers that are deal that, you know, where a pharmaceutical company can afford to spend $1 billion to research a drug if they think they're going to get a 10-100x return on that. So that's where most of the studies are being done. So these things are slow to evolve. But I do think that irrespective of any treatment you decide for cancer, nutrition matters. I mean, again, stop poisoning yourself is step one. And then if anything beyond that may have a better chance of being helpful.
A little bit of a trigger warning for people right here. I'm about to talk about my bathroom habits. So if that bothers you, trigger warning right here. I'm just letting you all know. We never do that for anything, but I feel like this was warranted. And I've friends that I've turned on to this. I had a friend, I was talking to him about it, and then he got a call from a childhood friend of his out of the blue that I don't know this other person, who said he had lost 100 pounds and his blood work had gotten down to healthy levels and he swore by it and blah, blah, blah. Separate sort of tentacles of the same octopus, so to speak. So he decided to do it and he ended up saying that he was constipated. Now, I have another family member that was always gassy, constantly. Right? Like in an abnormal way. And I used to tell her this, I'm telling you, this is not normal. You should see a doctor, whatever. The two of us started carnivore about the same time. I go through about half the toilet paper that I used to, if not less. Every Costco trip used to be toilet paper. Now it's every third Costco trip to get toilet paper. People say, aren't you constipated? No, I'm not. I'm not bloated. I just don't feel desire to go. Similar to when I had to recognize that my stomach was full, my brain was just telling me it was time to eat again. I had to realize I didn't have to go, as there were times in the beginning where I would try and force it. And there was just nothing there. We used to joke all the time, it's not ripe, was the joke, right? Can you explain that phenomenon to me and to some people that are watching saying, yeah, I tried carnivore, but I couldn't go to the bathroom. People seem to think going, having a bowel movement 2-3 times a day is healthy. And if you don't, it's not.
Yeah. Well, I mean, again, if we look at what is on the normal spectrum of bowel movements for humans, it is a couple bowel movements a day, too, as little as once a week, believe it or not, is considered within the normal range of human bowel frequency. And obviously, what is the purpose of our colon? I mean, part of it is to store waste until we can get rid of it in a convenient time, right? The thing about a carnivore diet is because you're not consuming really any fiber, and there was just a brand new paper just came out, was just published showing that people that consume a higher fiber diet have triple the amount of feces that they're gonna have to deal with, and much of the nutrition that they're consuming is actually excreted in the feces. So you're like literally like flushing food down the toilet when you consume in that way. So when you're on a carnivore diet, almost all of your nutrition is absorbed in the small intestine. So you have very little waste product. Which if you have dogs are great on carnivore because you're not having to clean up dog crap all the time. It's cut down tremendously to about, you know, a third of the amount. So that is a normal finding, is just, you know, once it's dialed in, and there are some transition issues that occur sometimes, but once it's dialed in, yeah, you just go to the bathroom less. And it depends on, you know, depending on how much I'm eating, you know, sometimes I'll have a bowel movement every day. Sometimes it's every other day. Sometimes it's twice a day. It just depends on how much I'm eating, but I eat a lot, you know, I'll put down 5 pounds of meat in a day. So, I mean, it's like, and you know, I'm like 5 pounds of meat a day. And that's all that came out, this little teeny bit. So it just tells you the efficiency of what you're doing. And we are well designed to absorb meat. That is what our digestive tract is very, very good at. And this sort of belief about, oh, meat rots in your colon is nonsense. There's no evidence of that. Think about that. If you think about the times you've looked in the toilet and saw what you pooped out of you, how many times have you seen a piece of steak floating in there? Never. And if you did, there's something really wrong. You might've seen some corn or some collard greens or something like that, but you never see meat that's in there because it is completely and utterly absorbed in our body. And that's good nutrition. That's what that's why we eat, is to get nutrition. And this is the most efficient way. You know, you think about it, of all the planets that have ever swam, crawled, flown, walked on planet Earth, something like 85% of them have been carnivore. They have had a carnivore preference because it's more efficient. It is a more efficient way to do this. And the herbivores require all this specialization, specialized digestive tracts to extract the nutrition out. I liken it to like, if I were going to build a brick house, I'd like to have some bricks available, right? It'd make it a lot easier. But if I got straw and mud, then it's a lot more work. And that's the same thing. When we're building and maintaining animal tissue, animal cells, well, guess what? Consuming a bunch of animal cells, it's just more efficient. You know, when you got to pull apart cellulose and do all this other stuff, you got incomplete amino acids and poor ratios, it's less efficient. So this is a very efficient way to digest, to nourish ourselves, and you don't have as much waste. And that's what's going on with that.
I'm an every 3 to 4 day guy now. It scared me.
Still sticking with the poop conversation, Bobby.
Yeah. Warning is not over yet. Christ. It's literally an every 3 to 4 day thing now, and I'm amazed by it because I'm not constipated. I'm not bloated. Changing the subject real quick. You mentioned dogs. Okay, so recently we had a dog that was having some problems. Switched her to the farmer's dog, which is a fresh frozen food. And something that was driving me crazy was she's on the beef package. And I find corn and lentils whole in her poop, literally whole. And I realized, okay, so what am I doing? I'm not eating anything anymore except basically meat, butter, and eggs. And I have this wonderful digestive tract that I didn't have before. The dog is literally shitting out little lentils. And I want to call the company guy, is this filler? I mean, is this so you could charge me more, less? What is it? You said dogs do great on carnivore. I've been thinking about doing that. What do you do? Just you throw beef raw?
Yeah, I mean, my dogs literally eat, it's kind of crazy, they eat a pound of raw meat a day. I mean, I've got two dogs, one's about 50 and one's about 20, and I take a pound of meat and I give the bigger one most of it and the little one less of it. That's it. Sometimes I'll throw a little bit of, there's a dried chicken treat that's pure chicken that I'll throw in there, but that's it. And they've been doing this for like, gosh, 6-7 years. And my oldest is a 12-year-old golden retriever. And I took her to the vet and she goes, she couldn't believe the dog was 12. She goes, I never see dogs in this good a shape. So, I mean, if you got an old dog that farts and scratches and is gray in the face, do an experiment. Stick them on a carnivore diet for 3 months and you'll watch that dog regress into almost a puppy. And that should give you some level to show you how much diet impacts us. And this, humans the same way, like you mentioned, your joint pain went away. I mean, I'm 57. I'm out here having aspirations of dunking basketballs and doing all this crazy crap that most 57-year-olds wouldn't even think is even remotely possible. And the only reason I can do that is because my damn joints don't hurt. Because I can train, I can run around and jump and spring and hop like I did when I was in my 20s and 30s. But most guys in their 40s and 50s, that's off the table because they hurt all the damn time. And diet does impact that. And that's something I had to learn the hard way as an orthopedic surgeon. You know, I went into orthopedic surgery because I didn't want to deal with all the crap of, you know, patients eating garbage and not taking their pills like the general practitioners do. I thought, you know, somebody breaks their arm, I'll throw a plate on there, get them back to business. If their knee hurts, I'll replace their knee. And that works to a degree, but 80-something% of what I saw was just people's bad habits. Their metabolic disease manifesting as orthopedic problems. And so once I realized if you fix the metabolism, you fix that garbage diet, stop them, get people to stop poisoning themselves, most of these orthopedic issues go away. And then all of a sudden you got people that are like, shit, I feel 20 years younger. That's a good thing. That's a good place to be.
And I'll say this to Jimmy, because Jimmy and I, you know, we're similar a lot of ways. Like you said, he's basically a ketogenic diet with a couple of outliers like his vodka. But Jimmy and I talk about this all the time. Friends of ours will be like, because we're both, I mean, you have world records, like the rowing world record, which I want to talk about. But, you know, Jimmy and I are casual athletes. We work out. Jimmy does plyometrics. I know you talked about that a little bit, Dr. Baker. And we could touch on that if you want, Jim. How many friends do you have our age? We're both basically 57, right? And how many friends do you have our age? Yeah, Jimmy's a little higher than that. That like say, oh, we're old now, bro. Everything hurts. It's because we're old. And I'm like, nothing hurts on me anymore. Literally nothing.
Yeah. I generally tend not to hang out with downer people that, you know, to bring me, because I'm not interested. I'm like, hey, you guys go, you know, I remember when I was competing in the Highland Games and there was a guy, Mike Babb, he played for the Cincinnati Bengals and he was competing. He was doing pretty good, still looking young. And I was in my 40s time and he was like hanging with us and he goes, oh shit, it's my turn. I got to go back with all those old fuckers. You know, it was like, because he didn't identify with those guys. He said, I don't want to hang out with those guys because they bring me down because they're all like, ah, my back and my head. I'm on all these meds. It's like, F that stuff, man. Let's just get after it. So, yeah, I mean, I think it is a very small minority of people that are actually feel good as they get older. And it's just, you know, you can see by about age 40, you get these people that are just, I mean, they're already dead. They're just waiting to be buried. And you got a small percentage of people that are like, hey, life is still good. Let's have fun. So, I mean, yeah, it's such a big difference in quality of life.
By the way, this is one of my favorite conversations we've had in a long time. I just want to get, like, there's something I missed because my dog was going in for cancer surgery on Thursday and going to remove part of her back foot. She's 11. You feed it just raw. You feed your dog just raw ground beef. Is that what you said?
Yeah. There's a, you know, it's interesting because I fed him cooked meat for a while. And one of the problems, and we see the same thing with humans, is rendered fat. They end up having diarrhea. So they actually tolerate raw fat better. And dogs are freaking wolves. I mean, literally they're bred down wolves. I mean, they should have the same diet as a wolf, you know, basically, and it's a bunch of raw meat. So they do, but you know, it's arguable if you want to add some organs and some uncooked bones. I mean, that's potential, but I just literally give my dogs friggin' cheap ground beef that I can get at the grocery store. And that's what I feed them. I think I spend about, I don't know, $4 or $5 a day feeding my two dogs, which I think, you know, if you care about your animals, you might as well, if you want to have animals, at least treat them well. It's not that less.
I'll just stop my cup.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So, and they're happy. I mean, those dogs are like super excited. It's like me when I sit down to a frigging ribeye steak, I'm literally dancing around. I'm drooling. My dogs are the same way. Like, hey, it's time to eat. And they know it. They know it's good for them.
Want to hear something funny? Before we started taping, I actually came home early and made myself 4 scrambled eggs cooked in olive oil because I didn't want to keep talking about meat and be hungry the whole time we were filming this. I swear to God, I did that. But anyway, can you walk us through Like, you wake up on a Monday, what do you eat?
Steak. I'm serious.
So no butter.
Well,
no,
I mean, you can watch his YouTube and you'll see.
I mean,
his diet.
Without exaggeration, I've been doing this nearly 8 years. I've probably consumed, and again, without exaggeration, close to 10,000 steaks in 8 years. I mean, I eat 2 or 3 steaks every single day. I average about 3 pounds of red meat every single day. I've been doing so. I'm currently in a kind of a leaning out phase. So I mean, slightly less than that. Over the years, my diet has been, you know, with rare exception, I eat 2 meals a day, you know, at maintenance, I guess. I'm trying to maintain my body weight. I'll maybe eat 2 pounds of steak for breakfast. And then I usually try to eat dinner relatively early if I do. And it's about 2 pounds for dinner, or maybe slightly less. Sometimes I'll have some eggs. Sometimes I'll throw some seafood in there. I'll have some dairy occasionally, a piece of cheese occasionally, something like that. Rarely, I mean, we're talking a couple times a year. I might have a piece of cake. I was like, fuck it, I'm gonna have a piece of cake. But it's such a minuscule part of my diet that it's effectively, I eat meat pretty much exclusively with.
What about chicken? You didn't mention chicken at all. Do you have a problem
with
chicken?
Not so much. It just loses its appeal. You know, it's one of those things. It's like, you know, if I'm going to go to the store and like buy stuff, I'm like, I don't want chicken. I mean, it literally becomes, maybe a part of the fact because it's relatively lean and because I'm not consuming carbohydrates, I need energy. And where am I going to get that energy from? It's got to come from fat. So red meat has enough fat in it to where, you know, that you can get those energy requirements. And you think about, like, if we go back to like historically, like ancient humans, and we're like trying to optimize how many calories we can get, and our hunting capacity up prior to about 80,000 years ago was a spear. I mean, that's what humans used for the 300,000 years prior to that, or 200,000 years prior to that, rather. You know, how many chickens are you going to get with a spear? How many birds are you going to kill with a spear? Not a lot. So we were probably pre-wired to eat big, fatty, you know, grazing animals that we could catch and kill. And those started out a lot. To be honest, it's kind of funny. You read the history of what humans used to eat: elephants, mastodons, mammoths, lots of energy, relatively, believe it or not, easy to kill. Before that, we were eating a bunch of turtles. We were eating these giant tortoises because they were protected from every other species except for humans that could flip them over and crack their shell with a rock. So we started, all these fatty, you know, there were used to be gazillions of these giant turtles walking around everywhere because nothing could kill them until we showed up on the scene. And then we crushed all the turtles and then went through all the mammoths. And once our food supply ran out, now we got to chase little antelopes around, which are leaner. And then we got to add plants to that because there's not enough fat. So that's kind of the reason I don't generally consume chicken. I mean, I don't mind it. You know, like I think in the last, I remember I went to a party and they ran out of food. So I had to eat chicken. You know, like, I mean, when I would say they ran out of food, they ran out of meat. So I was like, only chicken left. I was like, okay, damn it. So anyway.
I have like 2 questions we have to get in, and we usually go about an hour. So we get about maybe 20 minutes left.
We usually lie to our guests and tell them we're going to keep them for 25 minutes, but then we keep them for an hour.
Yeah,
we are liars.
Really quick, I want to ask this question because I have a relative who actually reached out to me about the way that I was eating, because she saw my weight loss and she said, you actually look like you were reversed aged. And she asked me about it. And so I told her and she adopted it. But 2 things about this particular person. Number one, she hates the taste of red meat. Like literally she does eggs and cheese and burgers and cheese and that's it. Every once in a while she could throw a filet on there. I'm like, make sure you throw butter or cheese or something because you got to get the fat. But she dislikes the flavor of red meat. That's number one. Number two, she is going through menopause. So she's very up and down. Do you have any experience with the second part of that statement where menopause is kind of making her weight fluctuate differently and this and that, or is that something you don't want to speak on? And number two, any advice for someone who doesn't like the taste of red meat?
Well, I've got, you know,
I don't
I've
understand
got something,
like I saw your laugh.
To me, it sounds like a mental, no, I'm just kidding. I wouldn't say it's a mental disorder, but no, I mean, I think, you know, some people have been conditioned not to like it over a period of time. You know, they've associated whatever they associate with it. And so I think that, you know,
she's always been
My wife, when I met her, she was a sort of just transitioning out of vegetarianism. And she had like all kinds of gut issues.
Same with my wife.
She was eating fish a little bit. And it took me something like 5 years before she would eat red meat. And she finally had her first hamburger. And I remember so excited. I got her to eat red meat. And literally now, I mean, she's steak every day. Give me a steak. I want a steak. What do you got for me? And I need steak. So I mean, there is just a period of time where, I mean, it start, if you're going to stick with this, and you know, can you do a diet without red meat? Yeah, you can. I mean, is it maybe harder or maybe less optimal, perhaps? I mean, Stefansson, Vilmar Stefansson, who a lot of people quote as sort of a modern pioneer in this whole thought process. He's a guy that lived up with the Inuit Eskimos up in Alaska and Canada for all those years back in the early part of the 20th century. And then said, hey, I just ate meat for 12 years. No one believed him. So he did that experiment where he locked himself at Bellevue Hospital and they fed him meat for a year. And lo and behold, he lived and didn't die and was great in health. But he said that when he first got to, when they got stuck and their supply boat couldn't come in, they had to eat only fish for like 4 months. He was totally fine. He said, that's the best I felt in years. So it is doable in that regard. And, you know, maybe it's just one of those things where you just kind of gradually find what it is. And some people will find like a ribeye steak. I love a ribeye steak. I eat every little bit of all the fat and everything. But there are a lot of women particularly who have been conditioned. Oh my God, fat is bad for you. They cut all the fat off, or, you know, they don't like their steaks to be red. They like everything well done and dry and leathery. I'm like, oh my God, you're kind of my, you
know. Some of it's like a mouthfeel.
Yeah, it is. So there's some of that. So, I mean, it's, you know, it's like you can train, like, you know, there's ways. It's like, you know, if you need the fat and you can tolerate, say, a filet, well, you know, spend a little extra money, get a prime filet. So you get more fat in there, because you got to figure a way to get that fat in there. And, you know, render fat you can add, it can cause some GI issues. So that's one thing with regard to the menopause. I mean, yeah, it's a tough time. I feel sorry for women because, you know, they got to deal with that. And it definitely throws a number on a lot of women. But one thing I will tell you, is that I see a lot of women that are in various stages of their reproductive life, you know, whether it's pregnancy, you know, perimenopause, menopause, and so on and so forth. And without problems with fertility, without exception, most women will comment that this type of diet vastly improves their symptoms, or hot flashes, pain, sleeplessness, general dysphoria, you know, their ability to get pregnant, the healthfulness of their pregnancy. So, I mean, yeah, I mean, there's a transition period. And I mean, that's just going to take whatever it is, 2 or 3 years or however long the menopause lasts. I mean, generally, if you haven't had a menstrual cycle within a year, then you're considered to have completed menopause. I mean, I believe that's the conventional definition of that. So there is, I think generally the same rules apply. I mean, you know, get good sleep, don't be sedentary, get some regular exercise, do strength training. And then the diet becomes important. And some women in particular, you know, women are fatter than men. I mean, that's just, I mean, I'm not saying it in a disparaging way, but women carry more body fat than men for a reason. True. They have breasts and extra weight because they're designed to nourish a child and they need those reserves. So women, sometimes they need a little more fat, they need a little more energy. Some women claim they need a little more carbohydrate to make this work. So I think there are some things you have to do. And there is some evidence that the time of menstrual cycle, whether in a luteal phase or not, you know, they have changes in a little bit of things. But I mean, in generally, a lot of people like cravings for chocolate or sugar or something like that. That generally makes things worse. I mean, it's a short-term fix for a problem that ultimately it makes you worse. And so, yeah, there's a whole, we could talk for hours on women alone. In fact, when I went to medical school, I remember a guy complaining. He said, if we didn't have to learn the damn women's reproductive system, we could cut this whole process down by a year, you know, because there's so much to it. But yeah, I deal with a lot of women in their, you know, late 40s, early 50s, early 60s that are in this sort of perimenopausal group. And yes, they do struggle more so than the men do. Sorry for the women listening. But it's, you can get through it. And I think it's something that there are a few, I think, nuances there.
Do you know Dan Goh is today a Fit founder?
I believe I'm familiar with the name. I can't say I know in detail, but yeah, I think I've seen the guy.
He was saying that he's a fan of yours, and he's just loves the fact that you're trying to push people toward a more healthy lifestyle. He was under the impression that you have since, in the last, I don't know how much time frame, entered more fruit into what you believe is the ideal diet. Based on this conversation, it does not seem like.
Yeah, I mean, this is interesting. This is, you know, internet headlines and stuff like that. I included apples in my diet for 1 week for a very specific test I was doing. I was looking at this. There's a theory that if you are low carb, this is based on something called a lipid energy model. If you are very low carb and your glycogen depleted, your liver, in order to get energy to your cells, which need that, will upregulate the trafficking of lipids and cholesterol will go up. So can you reverse that by consuming carbohydrates? Well, there's a lot of evidence that you can. In fact, there's been several now published studies in the literature that shows that. So I was experimenting on myself, just maybe out of boredom, I don't know, because I want to experience things that I'm talking about. So I said, I'm going to eat 100 grams of carbohydrate per day. And I use apples just because I was like, oh, I like apples, they're convenient. And I did it for a week. It did not have a major effect on my particular LDL cholesterol, just because probably I was already eating a lot anyway. So I don't think I was glycogen depleted. That was it. I did it for a week and I didn't feel very good. In fact, my guts were like, oh, my guts are, it just really bothered me in a little way. So I said, okay, that was it. But that made a headline. I did an interview with a guy named Thomas DeLauer. He said, carnivore king eats fruit now or something like that. And that's, nobody listened to the interview. And so it's just basically, no, I don't eat fruit on any regular basis. I mean, in the course of a year, I probably have the equivalent of one apple's worth of fruit. I mean, just because I'm not a purist dogmatic, but I just don't eat it. I don't have a desire to eat it. I perform extremely well without carbohydrates, which I know goes against what most people believe when it comes to athletic performance. But anyway, it is what it is. I mean, I do what I do, and I do it without any significant carbohydrate.
I wanted to talk a little bit more about Rivero, because I actually was on the waiting list. And Dr. Baker, I told you a couple of days ago that I got the good news that I can fill out my application. And one of the reasons that I fill it out is, and you jump in and correct me anywhere I'm wrong, Sean, is that Rivero is being put together for some of the reasons we've complained about, to get people healthy in ways that don't necessarily involve surgery, don't necessarily involve prescription drugs, but ways that we can actually sort of control our aging. Can't stop it, can't reverse it, but control our aging and actually talk to doctors who are diet focused rather than pharma focused about what's going on. And I'm not going to share numbers, but I'll share something that has me a tiny bit concerned. I have always had triglycerides higher than the medical profession believes to be safe. Okay. I know I'm not at risk for pancreatitis. I'm not anywhere near that high, but that's what I want to discuss at Rivero. And I don't want to discuss it with regular doctors because I'm just going to get a prescription. Yeah. My entire family on both sides has had high cholesterol. I could go back three generations. There's been not one heart attack and not one stroke that anybody can find. And I'm not saying that these things are hereditary. I'm just saying, why didn't they have them? They were all fatter than me. Most of them still are. And they all had this high cholesterol. And I want to know what's going on with myself and if there's changes I can make. So I just want to mention Rivero again before I ask you one more question. What is the triglyceride sort of fear level that somebody should have? Because you already said they shouldn't dismiss cholesterol. You said it's not the factor alone. There's other things that are involved. So can you talk a little bit about triglycerides?
Yeah, well, I mean, firstly, thanks for mentioning Rivero. And again, we have physicians that are all, like you said, they're focused on diet, nutrition, lifestyle, rather than just pharma first. It's sort of the, like it should be. It should be the reserve for the last resort. And hopefully we can de-prescribe rather than prescribe for the majority. So triglycerides are obviously a risk factor for cardiovascular disease. That's well established, you know, and the upper limit of normal is usually quoted as like 150 milligrams per deciliter, I believe. And, you know, you see some people where it's in the thousands. And yeah, you're right. Some people will develop pancreatitis when it gets really, really high. There's a couple of things to realize when you're testing for triglycerides, because generally lowering carbohydrates often will bring down triglycerides. That is very well established, right? We have to realize that triglycerides are very responsive to when we eat, you know, things like coffee can impact that. One of the things I will say with a carnivore diet, when you, like, we'll go back to the bathroom thing a little bit. When we eat a steak, like if I throw down, you know, a 24-ounce ribeye, or sometimes I'll put down more than that, it's not going to be digested and disposed of within 6-8 hours. I mean, that ain't happening. I mean, it's literally, we talk about these drugs, GLP-1 receptor agonists, right? Beef is actually slowing our digestive tract down. As soon as those little beef molecules, the amino acids and fats, start getting into the distal small intestine, into the ileum, and the L cells start sensing it, all this GLP-1 is released, and it tells the gut, slow everything down. We got stuff we need to absorb. So it slows everything down. So you're actually digesting a steak for maybe 12, 16, 18 hours. And in that period of time, if you test your blood, your triglycerides are likely to be high because you're still postprandial. It's not a fasting number. So if you want to test triglycerides in a steak eating state, I would suggest you fast for 18, 24 hours, then get it again and then see. Also, coffee can, for some reason, a friend of mine, Dave Feldman, looked at this and saw high triglycerides, and he found that in a significant percentage of the population, coffee seemed to impact their triglycerides, and often it raised it. So those are a couple of variables you just have to be mindful of. But in general, triglycerides, you know, there's some evidence that something called de novo lipogenesis has to do with that. And so sometimes it's just excessive energy. And so my prediction is, as you get leaner and leaner, as you perhaps any visceral fat that may be remaining is being washed out or, you know, or metabolized out, your triglycerides will fall, particularly given you pay attention to the timing of the test, because that is critically important, you know, particularly for triglycerides.
Really important for me to hear, because my doctor, who I've gotten the blood work on, he the last one, he goes, everything looks good, just your cholesterol's high. And I realized the last two batches of blood work were not fasted, not even close. Like, I might have had a ribeye the night before and a four espressos before I went and got my coffee pulled, or my coffee. My blood is coffee. I had before I went and got my blood pulled. So it's nice to hear that that's actually could be a mitigating factor there.
So Dr. Baker, this is probably the last question, then we'll let you go. Sorry about that. But we mentioned, for people who don't want to jump in and be where you two guys are, where they just eat steak and Bobby eggs and butter. We mentioned foods to avoid that are contra to the whole health journey. And that would be, obviously, sugar is the top of the pyramid, in my opinion, and hopefully yours too, but I'm not putting words in your mouth. Processed food, alcohol. What other foods do you think are really a sock to the nards for a good, healthy diet? And Bobby, we are trying to bring back the word nards. It kind of went on in the 70s and 80s. We're trying to bring it back.
I like it. And on top of that question, Dr. Baker, what's a vegetable that surprises people that they maybe should get away from that kicks their metabolism in the nards?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, the donut is probably the prototypical worst food you can come up with. I mean, it's refined grains, it's sugar, and it's some, you know, unnecessary oil, basically. It's, you know, it's just, and it's hyper, bad, it's, right. You know, very, you know, hedonically pleasing, and it's hyper palatable. And I think, you know, the thing about processed foods, you know, it's interesting. There's a guy named Darius Mozafarian, who's at Tulane University, has been criticized wildly for his association with the Lucky Charms or Healthier Than Beef study. But among the data that he's put out, which is interesting to me, is that over the last, about 20 years, I mean, certainly, you know, we've all seen everybody get fatter and fatter, but the caloric consumption has not gone up significant in the last 20 years. Now, from 1960 to about the early 2000, yes, we saw about a 300-500 calorie increase per capita, per person per day. But after that, subsequent to that, we don't eat that much more calories, but the BC rates are skyrocketing still. And one of the things he points out is when you hyper process foods, when you turn food into powder, you know, you think about it. If you and I were to go out in the woods and get dinner, we would not come back with powder. There's no powder out there, right? And so that powder dramatically alters the surface area. So when you're eating cakes and flours and sugars and, you know, even protein powders to a degree, that powdered stuff is absorbed in a very different way. You know, it's absorbed very rapidly in the proximal or the upper part of the intestines. Whereas before, if it's not powderized, well, some of it makes it farther down the chain, and then the microbiome eats it. So the microbiome can eat up to 22% of our calories. So if the microbiome is not getting the food because it's all processed and we suck it all in, guess what? Even though we eat the same amount of food, we're actually absorbing more calories. So avoiding, I think in general, just avoiding ultra processed foods. And I know there's people out there say there's not all bad. There's some good ones. Look at whey protein. But in general, if you make it a rule to not eat packaged processed stuff, you know, we heard it, avoid the center of the grocery store. I mean, that's pretty true. Just avoid all that crap and stick to whole foods with single ingredients. It shouldn't be an ingredients label. If you're eating ingredients, you're eating the wrong food. I mean, in general, I mean, you know, obviously, you know, there's somebody, I want to put mustard on my damn, you know, whatever, hamburger and what's in the mustard or something like that. But that's probably the biggest thing I can tell people. If we can just avoid that, probably most people would do pretty well with that. And that includes obviously a lot of sugar. I mean, if you go to this grocery store and flip over boxes, it's going to have some form of sugar, some form of refined grain, and some oil, some canola oil, soybean oil, whatever, even butter. Right? That just doesn't really matter. I mean, it's just wasteful calories, which are devoid of any nutrition, and that's making people sick. As far as vegetables are concerned, you know, I don't know. I mean, I don't like vegetables. I never liked them as a kid. I don't like them as a adult. I was forced to eat them. My dad,
taste my wife's eggplant parmesan. You change.
Well, anyway, yeah, but I mean, you wouldn't eat a raw egg. But I mean, you know, that's because it's disguised by the cheese and the other stuff. I mean, it's I mean, if you just eat like plain eggplant, you'd be like, F this, I ain't eating that stuff. So, I mean, you think about it, eat a vegetable by itself with no dramatically altered seasoning and flavoring. And it's like, these things suck. So I don't know if I could give you one, you know, I mean, all plants have some level of toxicity. I mean, that's the truth. I mean, of course, humans have been eating them for millennia, millennia. Not everybody's dead. Not everybody's dying. So there's some level of what's the dose, what's the tolerance of that. I mean, you know, most of these plants have, I mean, they've been fighting against fungi and insects for hundreds of millions of years, before, well before we came along. And so most of these things, like caffeine, is a neurotoxin for insects. I mean, but it has effects on the human body. But so, I mean, it's like, I mean, there are, like, for instance, everybody loves cruciferous vegetables, broccoli and cauliflower and all these things, kales and all these things. And they can be high in things like goitrogens, which can negatively impact the thyroid for some people. I mean, it's, you know, I mean, here's an interesting statistic. You know, autoimmune diseases are on the rise, and they've been going up and up and up, but the vast majority of people impacted by autoimmune disease are women. I mean, it's almost 2-to-1, right? Interestingly, and I know this is correlation, somebody says, no, just correlation, but interestingly, women are far, far more likely to eat way more vegetables than men do. I mean, is there a relationship there? I don't know. I do know that when I get people with autoimmune disease and I pull the vegetables out, a lot of times their autoimmune disease goes away. So, I mean, it's just, you know, obviously we need to do studies on this, and hopefully there are some forthcoming. I'm like I said, I've been trying to get funding for these studies, which I think are very much needed. You know, I mean, I can imagine people out there, why the hell would you be studying the bad effects of vegetables? We can't get people to eat enough of them. But I mean, it's like, you need to know. I mean, you need to know if something's actually a problem for you. And the easiest way, I mean, you know, in absence of some, you know, well-funded RCT, randomized controlled trial, just try it yourself and see, hey, let's see what happens if I give up the vegetables for a week. Because, I mean, a lot of people honestly do better without, I mean, I talked about that, you know. A lot of people, women in particular, they're so used to bloated guts. They're just like, you know, they're in there proud of their little food baby. And they're like, oh, look at me and my leotards. And now my guts looks like I'm 3 months pregnant. And they said it's normal. And I would argue vehemently it's not normal. And like, we have this condition called IBS, irritable bowel syndrome, which now some studies suggest up to 20% of the population is affected by that. And it's probably accurate. It might even be higher. And in my view, IBS should not be called irritable bowel syndrome. It should be called you're eating the wrong damn food. And, you know, because your gut should not hurt. I mean, I don't know, you know, Bobby, you can comment on me, but when you eat a steak, when I eat a steak, man, I don't even know I'm digesting anything. It's just like I literally could go out and run around and I don't feel anything, which is how I think your system is supposed to be.
It's completely different. It's completely different from when I used to eat steak along with other foods. Like if I ate a steak sandwich at Joe's Stone Crab in Chicago and I dunked it in the horseradish sauce with the onion roll and I had the French fries and all and the salad with it and stuff, the next day I'd be like, wow, that steak is just sitting in my gut.
Yeah, well, it's a filler. It's all
that
a filler.
Wasn't it. Yeah. That wasn't
exactly.
It. The steak doesn't. I know we're running out of time, Jimmy. I'm sorry. I got one more question I promised I would ask.
You got to rein in this circus occasionally.
I know. It's just, we need to have another hour with you a couple of months from now.
That's fine. Yeah.
But it just, the last thing I have to ask is seed oils. They obviously just fall under processed foods, right? And is olive oil a seed oil, considering that olive oil is a fruit?
Well, I mean, the short answer is olive oil is not a seed oil, technically. You know, I mean, we have been eating olive oil for a long time. I mean, that goes back to, you know, the ancient Greeks and probably other places, I imagine, all throughout the Mediterranean where they grow. I think the seed oil thing is an interesting debate. I don't eat them because I just don't eat processed food. I mean, I have no reason to eat them. I mean, one, I think,
they mess me up.
Well,
now,
yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, to me, the animal fats taste better. They have better performance characteristics in many ways. I mean, you know, if you want to cook a steak, cook it in tallow or ghee or, you know, duck fat or something like that. Whether they are uniquely dangerous is debatable. I know there's people that are very vehement about on both sides of this. I mean, I think there's no downside to not eating them, in my view. And I, like I said, if you were to say, I'm not going to eat anything with seed oils, you would probably eliminate 95% of the ultra processed foods out of your diet. Just by doing that one thing alone, because they're in everything. They're cheap. They're basically useless calories. And all they do is fatten people based on their caloric content alone. And do they have additional oxidative damage or inflammatory properties? That's debatable, depending on who you talk to and which research they're citing. But again, I don't think there's a real negative for eliminating them for most people.
Most people who have said to me, I need to have my salad, I've said to them, have it without the dressing and tell me what you think. Because it's a vehicle for the dressing.
It's a vehicle for
so
dressing.
Olive oil, you're sort of okay with at this point. You haven't It doesn't worry you.
But I ate a lot of avo. And I can't believe you didn't give the Italians credit when you have Bobby Iacino and Jimmy Urio interviewing you and you gave the Greeks credit.
Maybe you can educate me. Who invented olive oil?
We will never admit the Greeks invented anything. So it doesn't really matter. We'll never admit it.
Can you do me a favor? Can you spell Rivero so people can find it?
Yeah, it's R-E-V-E-R-O. Rivero. R-E-V-E-R-O.com. You can go there. We've got something now like 10,000 people on the waiting list. So, I mean, I know, Bobby, you got the letter, but we're open.
We're not having to sell anything for you. We have to
match the number of patients with the number of fresh. So we're hiring more physicians. We've got a lot of doctors that want to work for us because they're tired of the system too. They're just tired of the BS and they want to just actually help people. So it's really cool.
That there is enough reason to talk again, man. I just feel like I threw words in your mouth. So I can't say goodbye without. You have no problem with olive oil. You just don't eat it. Is that right?
I think if you're going to exclude an oil based on things that you think might be a problem, olive oil is probably one of the better ones out there, to be honest. I mean, there are people that have salicylate sensitivities and there are potential issues for some people, but for the vast majority of people, like I said, I don't think everybody on the planet needs to be on a carnivore diet. I've never said that. You'll never hear me say that. But there are some people that have, I mean, gluten intolerance is well understood at these days, even though a lot of people are skeptical about it, but there's some pretty good research on that. There are problems with all kinds of food problems. And you just have to recognize that just because people said eat your vegetables doesn't mean that, your grandma tells you they're good for it. There can be problems. There really are people that have issues with this. And you have to be open-minded enough to say, maybe I don't need to be eating, a pound of spinach salad every day. Maybe that's actually a net negative for me. I used to do that stuff. And I remember I gagged those damn spinach salads down because I put, and I put all the balsamic, vinegar and olive oil and eggs and bacon bits and, cranberries and nuts on there. And that's the only part I like. I didn't like the spinach, but I ate it because I thought I had to. And then, it turns out maybe I don't need to eat that stuff.
By the way, Jimmy and I think Italians invented steak too. So
we think we invented everything.
Maybe they did too.
Okay, we have to call it now. I got work to do. I got a haircut appointment. But thank you so much, Dr. Sean Baker, for being here. This has been one of my favorite conversations. This has gone a solid 10 to 15 minutes longer than most of our podcasts do. However, I'd like to thank you guys watching the most. Remember what Bobby and I's mission is. And by the way, this was in just this whole week on NBC Local Chicago News. They're doing the introduction to the vegetarian vegan diet. And they have 10 minutes of every newscast in the evening. My wife has it on, which is irritating to me. But anyway, and they're doing it. So the mainstream media that Bobby and I were once a part of and we broke up from, we believe they're lying to you. We believe they're not furthering your interest. They're furthering the interests of the sponsors. That's why we're doing this. Do we have an axe to grind against them? Yes, we do. Do we plan on eventually taking them down and creating the world's largest media empire? Yes, we do. Thank you, Dr. Sean Baker, and thank you guys for watching us.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Sean.